Well, Luke, that was another interesting episode with Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resource Council. What was your main takeaway?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to cover in this episode. I love Fitz. I think he's a phenomenal speaker and one of the most knowledgeable guys when it comes to energy laws and energy production in the state. That's why you constantly see him in Frankfort giving his opinion, trying to educate lawmakers and lobby for the causes that he cares about. But I think his discussion of the role of nuclear power was one of the more interesting aspects, because I think for many people, like especially when I was younger, maybe in high school, you heard argument made that nuclear was going to need to play the role of bridge between traditional fossil fuel sources and a more renewable, sustainable energy infrastructure that couldn't make that transition without having nuclear plants carry a larger load.
Well, and I think, you know, I mean, I see Forbes articles all the time, like constantly. Forbes just pushes this idea that nuclear is going to be the bridge.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see kind of that counterpoint to it. And with that said, I think part of the reason that maybe Fitz and other people have decided that nuclear doesn't need to be the bridge now is because renewable energy has just come so far.
Well, that's a part of it. I think he makes a phenomenal point, though. He honestly convinced me in the course of that interview decidedly that like it is not going to play that bridge role that, you know, I think previously many people, myself included, might have assumed, because the licensing and actual construction of those facilities is so onerous. You couple that with like this NIMBY attitude of people not wanting to live near a nuclear power plant, which that exists nationwide. There's not a good place to put these where you're not going to have tremendous public pushback. And the federal and state regulations that you would have to overcome in order to get one licensed, it just doesn't seem feasible to try and get more nuclear plants up and running in a time period that's going to make them viable as that, you know, bridge. So I think, you know, he makes a really strong argument, and it's not, I think, what you could even still hear in like the discussion around this topic. But yeah, it was an interesting and I think super well stated point.
Yeah, and it is interesting. I will be curious to see how quickly we can move into more renewables. I mean, I think we've seen this before where, you know, we've talked about this before, that renewables are growing, but the big market shifter in the energy sector has been natural gas basically just killing off coal.
Yeah.
Like that has been the huge influx, and it's given renewable a little bit of room for growth, but really that's not the big changer at this point. It's natural gas.
Yeah, it led to the U.S. becoming the largest single producer of fossil fuels in the world as of, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. I can't remember specifically when we took the crown, but with the advent of horizontal drilling and fracking technologies, or at least the widespread adoption of them, you know, we've seen the natural gas production across the U.S., especially in like the shale covered regions of the Midwest, it's just exploded, you know, and that's, you know, as the discussion alluded to, that's really the main driving factor in why coal production here in the state has waned and is likely to decrease even more significantly in the coming years, you know, which threatens dramatically to reshape the economic landscape of Appalachia.
Yeah. And I think another thing that he talked about that I thought was really important was net metering. And I understand the perspective, I guess, of utility companies wanting to charge like, you know, maintenance fees and things like that in order to ensure that they're able to continue to operate in the system. But net metering, I understand where it's coming from with the utility companies, that they need to pay for maintenance and different things to keep their lines and the grid operational. Totally understand that. But I think they're trying to argue for a problem that isn't here yet when you're arguing for net metering, right? That could be an LG&E or any of these local utilities can struggle in theory to pay to maintain their grid if everyone had solar panels. But with just the amount of people that currently have solar panels, there's no way that that is having a dramatic impact on their budgetary, you know, guidelines for how they have to operate their grid system.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Not enough people, as it stands, are feeding power back into the line to substantially affect their bottom line. And but as it's, again, as it stands, they do have a duty to keep those lines operational for all the consumers within their sphere of influence. And I think this,
and one more thing I think that's really important too there is, I've said this before, I would be okay with utility companies adding net metering and potentially even raising their rates like they have been if local municipalities were holding the utility companies accountable and saying, okay, if we're going to give you this 5% increase, 7% increase, the utility company, you have to have a certain percentage, 10% of your energy production coming from renewables, or forcing their hand to have more growth, because you can't say that them increasing their rates, the utility companies increasing their rates and lobbying and getting these net metering bills in, that is setting renewables backwards. You have to have some sort, you can't have both. You have to either eliminate net metering or you have to hold the utility companies accountable.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think this whole discussion does play into the white paper that we wanted to cover in today's reaction, which was titled "The Implications of Smart Grid Innovation for Organizational Models in Electricity Distribution." And really what it's talking about is the current state of the energy distribution network and how utility companies have, for many beneficial policy reasons to this point, have become vertically integrated monopolies that are state sanctioned in many cases to operate within a sphere of influence that is pre-designated, and how changing technologies and possibly some smart grid technology could open up an avenue for more market-based, more competitive electrical distribution environment. So when we talk about smart grid in this paper, we're talking about technology that's going to let the consumer easily monitor their electricity usage across their house and the rest of their property. And not only that, engage in a way with a potential, like not currently existent, but a potential market for energy production. So like you would be able to determine the source of your energy, like which company is producing it in a scenario where there's like market competitors, which doesn't currently exist. And also you could maybe choose the type of electricity production you want. So you'd be able to choose to put your house on maybe a more expensive type of electricity that is generated by fossil fuel by renewable sources, you know? So like it would give the consumers a choice in where they're purchasing their electricity from that currently does not exist.
Well, isn't that exactly what, when we talked to Adam Eland last season about his, you know, more commercial renewable energy plan, because essentially corporations are already doing this, right? Yeah. From the company side, they're doing this, but you're talking about transitioning this to make it so that local individuals, homeowners have the opportunity to choose where their electricity is coming from.
Yeah. And again, this is not a technology. The technologies themselves may exist, but they're not in place anywhere across the United States. Okay. This is really a theoretical thing. It's a combination of existing technologies being implemented into our existing grid, or maybe supplementing our existing grid, that would give consumers a choice and open up like a competitive market in what is now a closed state-sanctioned monopoly that is the energy production sector. And the implications of this are dramatic. You know, you've seen small test markets of this type of technology in places like Belgium or other small municipalities across Europe with varying results. But really the idea is that the grid that we currently have is going to be in some way threatened by a more distributed, disaggregated, sustainable energy production sector. You're going to have fluctuating levels of energy production, and you're going to have more more producers trying to piggyback off of the existing grid, which is going to necessitate changes to the actual hardware structure of our grid. And if we know we're going to need to make changes to it, this is one proposal for making it, I think, more accessible to the consumer and opening up choice for the consumer.
You're asking to put capitalism into the energy game.
Yeah. It would be a more free market. It would be a more free market approach, but one that allows access and choice to the consumer, specifically with regard to the means of production, which is one thing that, mm-hmm. If you want to have a house that's run wholly on sustainable energy, the only way to achieve that now is to yourself provide the materials. You're gonna have to buy the solar panels, mm-hmm. buy a windmill, something like that, and then hook it up to your house. This would, in theory, give people the ability to just kind of push a couple buttons, flip a switch, and move your house from the traditional utility model onto, drawing electricity from a company that is solely producing using sustainable resources.
Well, I get the probably initial knee jerk or gut instinct reaction regarding, utility companies would never want to do this because they'd be signing themselves up for competition.
Yes.
But that said, they maintain the grids. So they would be getting some sort of fee or license just for maintaining the grids from whatever competitor that they would have, right?
You'd have to imagine either that scenario, or you'd have to have maybe the state getting involved and maybe assuming control or something of some aspects of the grid through some kind of eminent domain or something like that. And again, cannot emphasize enough, this is not happening right now. This is theoretical, but it is an interesting idea. And I think it's one potential response to the issues that a more distributed energy production model present.
I would pay the extra, even if it was an extra $50 a month, I would do that to ensure that I could have renewable energy.
Yeah, I think this is an area where consumers would benefit from choice. And I, it's interesting to think about, and that's why I chose the paper. It also highlights some of the other issues incumbent on the current monopoly that we have, and the implications of having a grid that is wholly maintained by energy producers that are losing market share to increasing renewable energy production. I don't know. But moving on, I guess I want to talk about the actual benefit that the Kentucky Resource Council provides to Kentuckians and similar outfits may provide across the nation. And that's that providing a nonprofit legal service in the realm of environmental law is a phenomenal benefit, especially in a state here like Kentucky, when you've got a very coal-dependent region in Appalachia that is not just dependent on it for jobs and energy production, but it is also most directly adversely affected by the burning of coal and the remnants and byproducts of mining. To be able to step up and provide representation for a traditionally marginalized group, a portion of our society, in a complicated and complex area of the law such as environmental law, that is just a phenomenal benefit to our community. And I really want to thank Fitz and everybody that works at the Kentucky Resource Council. It's an unbelievable outfit, and I know they're going to be sorry to see him stepping down from his position of director at the end of the year.
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing, is recognizing the important role. There are so many lobbyist groups out there, right? But recognizing the important role that particular groups play and what they're fighting for. And it's difficult to be aware of everything that's going on in not just Frankfurt, but in local governments across the country. So it's important to find and recognize the groups like the Kentucky Resource Council that are pushing good policy.
Yeah, absolutely doing good work, And I mean, to highlight some of the issues that we face within our state, I want to drop a statistic a fact that Fitz highlighted to me years ago that is still in effect. And that is if you get on the Kentucky Fish and Wildlife website, they have advisories, like statewide advisories for environmental issues that might be affecting our environment throughout the state. And if you go onto their advisories page, you can look. It's the very first thing. Fish consumption advisories are in effect for the following. Number one, statewide. We have a statewide mercury advisory that has been going on for years, for I believe decades, where women and children of childbearing age, and children under the age of six are not supposed to eat more than six meals of predatory fish in a given year that are caught out of Kentucky waterways. You know, and the reason that that is in effect is that mercury, which is a byproduct of burning coal, it gets aerosolized and then settles very quickly on the waterways throughout Kentucky, is consumed by fish that are eating algae off the top of the lakes, you know, pond scum, things like that. And that mercury builds up a bit, it bioaccumulates within their system, it gets absorbed into the cells, and then we eat it when we consume fish that are caught in Kentucky waterways. And so there's just a truly phenomenal amount of mercury that is saturating our waterways and funneling its way up the food chain, getting onto our plates if you eat fish that are caught in Kentucky rivers. And it's posing a legitimate health risk, a large enough health risk that we have to have a standing advisory statewide. And nobody knows about this. You know, it's like, I didn't know. I was 26 years old when I first learned about it, and I've lived here in Kentucky most of my life. You know, it was hard for me to imagine when he first said it. I was like, I almost have to look this up. And the second you get on the website, it's like right there in bold print. You know, they want you to know.
And that's just some of the good work that they're doing, like bringing to light some of these serious, serious issues.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't
know. But, well, that, again, like I said, great interview, and I think he shed a lot of light on a lot of different topics. But do you have anything else to add before we go?
No, I mean, we've got a ton of work to do, you know, and it's not going to be a quick transition, but we're on the right path. I think sustainable energy is on the rise, and that's what I want to see.
Yeah, hopefully we can figure out some good policies going forward.
So, yeah, absolutely, man.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. As always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Building This Community. If you'd like any more information, you can follow us on Twitter at BuildingThisCom, C-O-M, or you can follow Andrew
at Andrew J. Klump, and you can also follow Luke
at LMP43. Definitely subscribe, and we look forward to talking to you guys next week. Hey, 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 guys. Welcome to Building This Community.
This is your city business and policy development podcast. We're your hosts,
Luke Patrick
and Andrew Klump. Welcome to this week's episode of Building This Community. Our guest today is Tom Fitzgerald, who is the current director of the Kentucky Resources Council, an adjunct professor at the University of Louisville Brandeis School of Law, and who routinely makes appearances at the General Assembly in Frankfurt to advocate for a range of causes. Tom, how are you?
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. I just gave a little bit of your background, but can you just give a little more depth?
Well, sure. As you mentioned, I am a lowly adjunct over at the law school teaching environmental law and energy law. I have been there since 1986, I think, and I'm certainly not here representing the school, but my day job is as director of the Kentucky Resources Council. We are essentially a legal aid firm on the environment. We do air, waste, water, mining, utility policy, energy policy cases and issues. We don't charge for what we do and for the legal representation we provide. And we don't take corporate money or government money, government grants. And we essentially have been doing this work since 1984, trying to provide representation for those who can't find or afford representation elsewhere. So it gives us kind of a unique perspective on kind of the intersection of poverty and environmental pollution and energy impacts. And so that's, you know, that's the work that we do. It's fairly diverse and very rewarding, even though there's a lot of frustrations, because the folks who live downhill and downwind and downstream tend to take the hit when it comes to the production of goods and to the extraction of resources.
Well, I think that's just a super interesting space to occupy in the legal field. And I'm sure it gives you an incredible depth of knowledge about energy and environmental topics. So just diving right in, talk about Kentucky here. We have long depended on coal for both jobs and economic development, as well as energy in our state. But what role do you see coal having in the changing landscape of energy production, both here in Kentucky and throughout the rest of the United States?
Well, the role of coal in Kentucky has been declining precipitously. There have been for the past 70 years waves of mechanization, changes in the extraction and the processing of coal that have idled workers. But the most recent shifts in energy production really stemming more from the marriage of horizontal drilling into tight shale formations to extract natural gas that was thought to be unrecoverable, and hydraulic fracturing, which is the way of propagating fractures in these tight formations in order to extract the oil from the west and from the natural gas in the east, has really been a game changer in terms of utilization of coal, because the lion's share of Kentucky coal is steam coal, so-called, which is utilized for electrical generation in fossil fuel power plants. That market has become so difficult that a couple of years back, when EPA, under the Obama administration, was looking at the impact of future climate controls on electrical generating units or power plants, they indicated that there was no economic impact because nobody was building new plants. And that really has been the case. When you look at the landscape nationally, you're seeing a shift away from fossil fuel production in favor of, first, in favor of natural gas over coal, which is, you know, one type of fossil fuel for another. But you're increasingly seeing the evolution of battery storage as a way of capturing and storing renewable energy. So you've got power plants that are being shuttered because it is more economic to build solar or wind and couple it with large-scale storage in the order of 200 megawatts and more, so that you're looking at the ability to address the one issue with intermittent energy sources such as renewables, which is how to store for later use when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. So it's been a dramatic shift in Kentucky, and that has brought with it significant economic, cultural, political ramifications, including the structural loss of a base, a strong base of employment in the eastern Kentucky coal fields, and the creation of a new generation of abandoned mine sites that are being left by coal companies that are declaring bankruptcy and seeking to shed their responsibilities for reclaiming these sites. So there's a number of challenges that are created when you have an economy that has been disproportionately focused on extraction of a resource that is not being extracted at the same level. There's still uses for metallurgical coal. There's still coal that is being utilized for combustion, for electric generation. But the amount that is being produced in eastern Kentucky relative to what it was in its heyday is a small fraction.
So it sounds, based on the analysis you just gave, that the so-called war on coal that you often hear pundits talking about is not really being waged by policymakers, but it's more due to just traditional market forces. Is that a fair
representation? Yeah, I think it's a very fair representation. In fact, the senior senator from Kentucky was big on the rhetorical attacks on the Obama administration for waging a so-called war on coal. The day after the election, when the last president was elected, was asked, so now that the Obama administration has ended, are you going to see all of those jobs that you claimed were lost to this so-called war on coal, are those jobs coming back? And he said, well, we can't control that. That's a function of the market. So, you know, it's abundantly clear that that was a very cynical foil that was utilized to try to divide the voters and to hold out the false hope that those jobs would be coming back because somehow that they had been lost due to regulatory policy. It was a deeply cynical strategy. And coal never made the coal fields wealthy. It made the people who owned the companies wealthy. It made the Wall Street investors wealthy for a time. But yet it was the mainstay for a number of jobs and the spin-off jobs associated with them. And the coal industry over the decades never liked competition from other jobs, particularly high-paying jobs. And there were a number of factors, including land ownership patterns and judicial decisions that really acted to keep the region from diversifying and resulted in these sort of abject economic adverse consequences when the coal economy declined.
Well, and so, you know, another example that hit the coal country, right, is, you know, the opioid epidemic. And there's been a lot of decline in maybe economic opportunities in those areas because, you know, coal producers were such a major driver of the economics there. What do you think are solutions to those areas that have relied so heavily on coal?
Well, I think you're seeing the resilience in the spirit of folks with a number of different initiatives. The best initiatives are the ones that are place-based and are utilizing the skills and the talents of a highly trained workforce and adapting those talents to other areas. There are a number of non-governmental organizations, the Mountain Association down in Berea, that's been doing community economic development for a long time and with success. There are partnerships that are being done under the SOAR, the Shaping Our Appalachian Region Initiative. And there are a number of small businesses that are being developed in the region. But unfortunate the region is poorly understood by the pundits. You know, one of the more outrageous characterizations of the region was in the Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, which takes the dysfunction of one family and tries to generalize it into a cultural issue. And so there are initiatives that are being developed within the region to build a more sustainable economy. And so, you know, it's happening. It doesn't get the headlines. You know, it's the days where there's not something outrageous that happens that you don't hear about. But there are locally, you know, local businesses. Appalachian Harvest has been in the news a little bit. There are companies that are trying to do solar with justice, and they're focusing on creating solar arrays in areas that have been adversely affected by mining. So there's some creative thinking going on, a lot of it from, you know, folks in the region working with folks who are willing to put up some capital in order to support economic diversification. But it's, you know, it's hard. It doesn't happen overnight. And there's a legacy there of damage to the land, damage to the workforce in terms of health issues, premature morbidity and mortality associated with black lung. So, and the so-called, you know, the real costs of so-called cheap coal have been borne by that region. And I think we have a debt of honor to the folks in the region to help assist in that re-envisioning the economy, not to dictate it, but to help assist and enable it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And we've had many discussions on our podcast about the damage that's been done to the Appalachian region and the costs of the economics of that have gotten them to where they are today. But moving back to this discussion of energy production and particularly sustainable energy, the conversation as it's had now, often you don't hear much about nuclear power. But as you and I, Tom, have discussed in the past, I feel like nuclear power is kind of an essential element of the transition away from fossil fuels. Can you maybe talk about how nuclear can maybe play a bridge role in getting us to a more sustainable energy economy?
Yeah, I don't know that it does play a larger role than it currently does. Nuclear has provided about 20% of the nation's energy mix for decades, and it is maintained right at that level. despite heavy government subsidies for nuclear power, you have not seen much new production of new nuclear generation facilities. You're starting to see some that are being mothballed, actually, because of their age. But, you know, it is when you're looking at the mix of energy generation necessary to reduce the carbon footprint. Right. Now, in Kentucky, we don't like to talk about that much as a matter of regulatory policy. But the reality is the marketplace has been looking at that issue for some time. The power companies themselves, when they're doing integrated resource planning for how they're going to meet the needs of their customers, they project out a 20-25 year period and say, this is what we anticipate that electricity demand is going to be. And here's the mix of demand management and supply side that we are going to utilize in order to meet that demand. You don't see nuclear in the mix because, as Amory Lovins, who's a commentator and a genius, actually, when it comes to forward-looking energy policy, he said, you know, nuclear power has had an incurable case of market forces. There are simply less expensive and less fraught when it comes to low frequency but high impact failures that occur within the nuclear generation cycle. There are simply easier and less expensive ways to boil water to turn turbines to make electricity than splitting atoms. And so there is research out there, a new generation of reactors looking at thorium rather than uranium. There are research being done, largely government funded, but some in the private sector. But I don't see, if you're looking at the life cycle impacts of the production of various forms of electricity, I just shake my head when I hear people talk about nuclear power being having no carbon footprint, because the life cycle of the extraction, the milling, the enhancement of nuclear fuel is heavily carbon dependent. And so while the generation may not produce, you know, greenhouse gases, the life cycle certainly is very heavily weighted towards utilization of fossil fuels in order to create the preconditions for the generation of electricity. So I'm really overtly negative in it, but leaving aside the questions of waste management, one of the fathers of peacetime domestic nuclear use at Oak Ridge said it's really a Faustian bargain because we're looking at extremely inexpensive electricity now, and then we're requiring that future generations, you know, future scores of generations, are going to have the wisdom and the maturity to be able to manage the waste that are generated and need to be properly managed for a millennium. And so, you know, now he was a supporter of nuclear energy, but he realized that the footprint of waste management, particularly when we have no permanent repository for spent fuels, is one that is somewhat fraught. So even with all the government subsidies that cap the liability of nuclear plants in the event of accident, and even with the Department of Energy taking title to and paying for the storage of spent fuels because of its inability to deliver a permanent repository for the waste, you're really not seeing much development of the nuclear industry during the period of time that we will need a bridge to get us to a carbon-free electricity generation sector. So it really, it's been fascinating because I think what's eclipsing the nuclear is the development of battery storage for renewables. It's easier to site a renewable facility. It's easier to construct it. It is much less capital intensive. And with the ability to store in real time the energy to make the combination of the renewable technology and the battery technology to turn an intermittent source into a predictable source that is not intermittent because of the use of battery storage is really a game changer. And I think it may be, some people may think I'm nuts, but that's nothing new. But I think in your lifetimes, certainly, or possibly in mine, that you will see such advances that people will be going to Lowe's or going to, you know, some other store to purchase plug-and-play solar panels and batteries. So I think, you know, there's two visions going on right now. And one of them is replacing the current generation of the current model of centralized generation of electricity and then dispersal of that electricity through the transmission and distribution grid. And the other being individual homes that are powered by solar or geothermal and are plugged into battery storage and are not reliant on a central grid, but instead have microgrids in small areas that are more resilient and are less likely to disruption due to an increasingly unstable climate. So, you know, part of the infrastructure bill is looking at modernizing the grid. And Lord knows the grid was never intended to serve the function that it now serves, as was abundantly apparent in Texas, which has avoided integrating its transmission system into the national grid in order to avoid national regulation. But the lack of resilience within the Texas system was apparent during its crisis. And I think, you know, you've got forces that are pushing towards modernizing a central integrated grid and those that are pushing towards a more interdependent local grid or independent utilization and generation of electricity. So it's going to be interesting to see how all that plays out. I don't necessarily see the two as inconsistent, but what I do see is that the electric utilities, which are right now in a very slow death spiral of lower per capita utilization of electricity, coupled with the continued costs of maintaining the generation, transmission, distribution system, and the cost of upgrading it periodically. You have costs that are not declining, which are being spread over a customer base that is utilizing less of the product. Those costs still have to be paid. So people essentially are seeing serial rate cases that come in and they're paying more for using less. So there's going to have to be a change in the model that keeps the utilities whole, but does so by investing in and not losing money, but making money from making people more efficient and making electricity use more sustainable. So there really is going to have to be a change of mindset from utilities making money by selling a product to utilities making money by providing energy services that are sustainable.
Well, and I think that's one example that I've always thought of is that I think cities should do a better job of holding utility companies, not hostage, but accountable for transferring into more of a renewable production, especially if cities are going to continue to accept rate increases. But I guess on that point exactly, like, where do you think the sustainability energy sector should be aiming for change? Is it going to be the private sector primarily, or should we be looking to local, state, or federal legislation?
I think the private sector, to a great extent, is pushing for change. When you have big companies that come to Kentucky that are demanding renewables, then you're seeing a response from the utilities to try to meet that demand. Local governments have a significant amount of flexibility in crafting policies that attempt to plan for the future, to lower the footprint of the cities. But you have pushback from the various forces that are profiting from the current state of affairs. For example, we had a bill that was passed during the last legislative session that sought to prevent cities from adopting policies similar to what Berkeley, California did, which is to say that in order to lessen the carbon footprint, new construction, residential and commercial construction, will be all electric rather than natural gas. Now, the reality is a lot of that electricity is going to be generated by natural gas, but it was an effort, you know, electrification as an effort to try to lower the carbon footprint. It takes a combination of all of those sectors, and it takes citizens willing to engage and to be active in seeking to revise our policies in order to more fully account for the environmental impacts of energy production to make it happen. I've been very proud to represent three interveners in a couple of the pending cases in front of the Public Service Commission. The utilities for several years have been at war with the solar rooftop customers and have been seeking to end the one-to-one netting of energy generated by solar and fed into the grid and energy utilized by that solar customer at times where their demand is exceeding their own production of electricity. We had Kentucky Power Company in the middle of a pandemic seeking a pretty significant rate increase and seeking to end net metering. And then LG&E and KU currently have cases in front of the Public Service Commission. And I think that the commission has very thoughtfully, very carefully thought about how you determine the real cost of serving solar customers. And they have recognized that the solar power that is fed into the grid has a significant benefit for other customers and for the grid itself. And they're requiring, when you are coming in and saying, we're going to change this policy, to account for those benefits in determining what is the real cost of serving those customers. So they're very proud of the Mountain Association and Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, Kentucky Solar Energy Society, and locally in Louisville, the Metro Housing Coalition, who are my clients and are working together to try to arrive at a fair value for solar. So that's been a good process. So it takes everybody. And elections do have consequences when it comes to who is going to be in the decision-making mode at the local, state, and federal level. You know, because a lot of the federal energy policy comes out of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I think you're going to continue to see communities cities don't have Public Service Commission control over their development of their utility services. And so you're seeing some community-based solar, places like Berea. And I think you'll see, I think you'll continue to see efforts on the part of local governments and local communities to chart a new path that is more sustainable, that lightens the carbon footprint. You know, one of our great challenges as a nation is how do we share that technology with emerging nations. It's fine to say to other nations, we Western nations have fouled the nest pretty well with our fossil fueled binge over the past 100 years. And by the way, you nations that are trying to develop a more robust working and middle class and are trying to provide electricity and power to meet your needs, we don't think you should be able to do that because your carbon footprint is increasing. It's a little bit untoward for us to be preaching to other countries. What we need to be doing is technology transfer that says, hey, you can avoid this intermediate step of heavy capital investment in centralized generation using fossil fuels with these technologies. And we will help you do that. We will establish economic policies that are not ruinous for your country. We will encourage through the IMF, through the World Bank, through other mechanisms, the maintenance of healthy agricultural base and smart industrial development. So, we have the opportunity to lead. And I think that there's a certain moral responsibility in doing that rather than just attempting to lecture to developing countries about what they should or should not do, given the fact that while they are now an increasing large footprint, historically, those emerging nations are not the ones that are responsible for the current climate crisis.
Tom, you hit on it, getting back to something you touched on just a minute ago. You were talking about net metering laws, and that's something that I'm not sure the bulk of our listeners or generally people throughout this country are very well understand. So could you maybe give us a brief explanation of what net metering laws are, how they might affect people that engage with solar panel technology in their home or business, and maybe a brief history of how they might have changed here in Kentucky?
Well, sure. Net metering, the concept of net metering is that you have a customer who is generating renewable power, typically solar from rooftop panels, and they are not generating it for wholesale sale, right? There are so-called merchant facilities or qualifying facilities under the federal utility reform laws that are generating for electricity and are tied into the grid and are exporting that electricity for utilization for sale. We have actually about 27, I think, projects proposed for Kentucky that are utility scale solar arrays that are seeking to site in Kentucky because we have the solar resource. Our worst areas in terms of capacity for solar energy are better than Germany's best. And, you know, Germany has gone large into solar power. So we've got the resource here and a number of these large-scale merchant plants, so-called because they're generating at wholesale rather than being utility plants that are generating for their own customers. They're here because of the solar resource and because we have the interstate transmission grids. So they're tying into those grids because and generating because other states along those grids have renewable mandates where the legislature has said, we want you to generate a certain amount of your electricity for your customers with renewables. And typically it steps up over time. And so we're seeing a significant uptick from no plants of that nature 3 years ago to 27 that are in various stages of development now in Kentucky. But net metering is a small portion of the distributed generation issue. In Kentucky, the largest your system can be is rated capacity of 45 kilowatt hours. So you can't have a large array and be a net metering. The concept is you have a solar panel. It's plugged into the local distribution grid and you are generating electricity for your own use, but at certain you are generating more than you need. And that gets fed back into the grid through the meter because the meters are capable of reading electrical transmission in two directions. And so over the course of the billing period, you net out the kilowatt hours that you generate and the kilowatt hours that you use. And if you have more than you've used, then you get a credit that towards future need. And if you use more than you generated, then you pay whatever that cost is. And so net metering has been in place in Kentucky for many years. But in Kentucky, as well as around the country, the utilities have decided that they believe that these solar customers, because they're getting a credit that is at the retail rate of what electricity costs, that they're being subsidized by customers that aren't participating. Now, objective studies that have looked at it have said that there is a minimal amount of any subsidization. Now, the reason that there's a claim of a subsidy is because if I'm a solar customer, just like if I'm an energy efficient customer, I'm using less of the electricity generated by the utility in order to meet my needs. And the utility's cost recovery is, if for residential customers, is typically has two components. One of them is there's a flat charge every month for being a customer, so-called meter charge. The meter charge is not related to your usage. And then there is the volumetric charge, which is what you're being charged for each block of electricity that you use. And if you're more efficient, or if you're generating your own energy to meet some of your needs behind the meter, then you're going to use less and you're theoretically going to pay less of those volumetric rates. And so any fixed costs of serving you that are embedded in those volumetric rates are not being paid as much by you. So the utilities are claiming that that constitutes a subsidy because other users are having to pay disproportionately more for electricity because you're using less as a solar customer. Now, there's any number of analytical problems with that analysis, but one of the most glaring is that the solar customer who is generating electricity, which, you know, goes into the grid and is utilized by that person's neighbors, it never really goes into the the larger grid because of the nature of electrons. It's going to go where the demand is locally. There are any number of benefits that that fed-in solar is providing in terms of avoiding other costs. Because if I'm generating a kilowatt hour, utility didn't have to use its own assets in order to meet my demand. And so there's any number of benefits there that the utilities discount or refuse to recognize because they have decided that they don't want to encourage rooftop solar. Now, part of that, of course, is the utilities have developed their own solar, and they are able to recover the costs of building that solar and all of the operation and maintenance costs from the ratepayers, plus a return on investment if they're an investor-owned utility, that they don't get the return on investment when somebody else is doing the generation. And so it's really, it's almost a market power situation where they're trying to prevent a rooftop solar from becoming a more robust part of the energy mix. And the Public Service Commission, in a recent order on May 14th, in the Kentucky Power case, which if your listeners are interested, is case number 2020-00174. Their May 14th, 2021 order in that case was the first under the new net metering law that had the commission decide what is the value of the credit that is being given to the solar customer for the energy that it's being fed back into the grid. And they said, utilities, you need to stop looking at fed-in electricity as a burden and start to look at it as an opportunity. And so I think the more forward-looking states are looking at that. And I think that a lot of the investments that utilities are proposing, the advanced metering infrastructure, opens up opportunities to work together with solar customers in order to avoid new major capital investments that will save everybody money. But the utilities need to change their mindset, because right now they're kind of mired in the mindset of centralized generation and then radio transmission and distribution and a profit base or a economic model that is based on consumption.
That makes sense. Now, we are starting to wrap it up here. So we do absolutely appreciate your time, but we are trying
Absolutely.
We'd like to know, do you have anything that you'd like to promote here?
Yeah, anything you're working on?
A couple of things, one of them is, first of all, is everybody calls me Fitz, F-I-T-Z. I'm stepping down at the end of December as director after 37 years at the council. They are currently, the job opening is still there for a new director. So folks are interested, they can go to the Kentucky Resources Council website. There are also some opportunities for a continuing education for both citizen activists and for lawyers and law students through one of our programs, which is the Kentucky Environmental Leadership Initiative, Kelly. And so we are doing training programs. There was one that was actually done yesterday on how to gather information on environmental and energy-related issues. And it had Sarah Lynn Cunningham, who's the director of the Louisville Climate Action Network, along with Michelle King, who is with the local air pollution control district, talking about those issues. A couple of weeks back, we did one on Environmental Justice 101. Honored to have Jackie Patterson, who works with the National NAACP on environmental justice issues. And she and I co-presented, but it was wonderful to have her with us. So we have ongoing initiatives. There are some podcasts that were done last year, including opportunities in environmental law for law students thinking about a career in that field. So I would encourage everybody to get on the KRC website, listen to the podcast, and to, if you're interested in helping to shape future programming, there's opportunities to volunteer to work on those. So we're trying to create as John Lewis, whose first anniversary of his death was yesterday, as Congressman Lewis would say, we're all about causing good trouble, necessary trouble, to try to advance environmental justice and environmental health. So, and there are volunteer opportunities, so I'd encourage folks, but also just, you know, stay active, stay informed, and certainly don't be quiet. Making positive change happen takes everybody engaging in it in whatever ways they can, from a little time to a lot of time, anywhere that you plant yourself and work towards a more sustainable, more just economy is time well spent.
We're happy to get the word out about those opportunities and job openings. I think
what the Kentucky Resource Council does is super important work. As Andrew said, we've got to wrap it up. Before we can let you go, we do ask all of our guests the same final question. If you had the power to change just one policy here in Kentucky, it just kind of snap your fingers and make it happen, what would it be?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, that's a really good question. If I could change one policy, what would it be? There's so many answers to that in terms of economic justice, in terms of environmental justice, in terms of tax policy. It's really hard to answer that. I think what I would like to do is to see it's not something you could really do at the state level, but I think the power of money in the political sphere has really poisoned the environment in terms of a progressive policy and in terms of policy that enables and ennobles the average person. So I think that campaign finance reform is obviously a very important issue. But if I could change one policy, it might be to go back into Kentucky's statutes and to eliminate the so-called no more stringent than clauses. We have in many of our environmental programs a provision that says that the state agencies responsible for implementing the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Surface Mining Act, waste laws can apply for and receive federal approval to run these environmental programs. But our standards can be no more protective, no more stringent than the lowest federal standard. So we made a policy turning the federal floor of environmental protection into our ceiling. And that has had some very negative consequences, particularly as federal standards have been weakened during some hostile administrations. So I think eliminating the no more stringent than clause would be one. Maybe a second would be a constitutional right for a clean environment.
I couldn't agree more. Super interesting to hear about the no more stringent than clauses. I don't know that I was familiar with that prior to hearing it from you there, but unfortunately, Fitz, we do have to wrap it up. It was tremendous getting to talk to you, though.
And it's good to visit with you all as well. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time.
We'll pick back up with our reaction segment after a word from our sponsor.